You're listening to The Warehouse, a Speaking of show by WFSU. Last year, Tallahassee celebrated its bicentennial, and the Tallahassee Historical Society was at the center of many of the festivities. The rich tapestry of Tallahassee's history spans many different periods and includes several diverse cultures. Josh Johnson is sitting down with Will Gandy, the assistant curator of the Tallahassee Museum and vice president of the Tallahassee Historical Society, to discuss Tallahassee's history and all that goes into its preservation.
Hello, everybody, and thank you for tuning in to another episode of The Warehouse, a Speaking of show on WFSU. I'm your host, Josh Johnson, and today, like every day, we have an incredible guest. So much of this program lives in the present, in the future. Today, we're going to take it to the past, and we have just the guest to do that for us. Joining us today is Will Gandy, the assistant curator of the Tallahassee Museum and the vice president of the Tallahassee Historical Society. Thank you for joining us, Will. We appreciate you, man.
Thank you, Josh. I'm happy to be here.
All right, so jumping right into this thing and kicking it off square, for people that don't know, what is the Tallahassee Historical Society?
So the Tallahassee Historical Society is a nonprofit 501(c) and here in Tallahassee. Our main goal is focusing on educating the community about Tallahassee's rich history and inspiring a next generation of historians in the community.
So do you guys have like programming associated with it, with that mission statement? Are there things that you guys specifically do on a day-to-day or a month-to-month or a year-to-year basis?
Right. So we have a regular season that runs from October through May, and we have a monthly lecture series where we have historians and other museum professionals or other professional historians come and give a lecture on relevant topics for the region and for the surrounding area.
Sure.
So that's our main objective is to have those lecture series, but we do a lot of other things in the community.
Yeah, when you're dealing with especially southern towns like Tallahassee, and I've gotten this from a series of other guests and just from my own research, you can't really talk about them in isolation. You have to pull in the regional context, and so I'm glad to hear that that's happening too.
Right.
So out of all of the work that you do with the Tallahassee Historical Society,
sure,
and I'm sure there's some cross-pollination between that and the museum, what is your favorite part of it? And how did you get involved in the Historical Society?
Sure. Well, my involvement with the Historical Society came after my involvement at the Tallahassee Museum. Uh-huh. But I'll answer that first question first. Probably my favorite thing that we're doing right now is the Historical Marker Program.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an interesting program because we're able to, on a statewide level, kind of highlight some of the interesting sites around Tallahassee. Mm-hmm.
And how did you get involved in the Tallahassee Historical Society?
So I started off at the Tallahassee Museum, and I learned about the society through the museum, and I started attending meetings just as a regular member. And just because of my involvement at the museum and because of my interest level, I started to work my way up within the society. I was a board of directors member, then I was the treasurer, and then vice president, and yeah, now I'm vice president, treasurer, and I'm sure a couple other things. If Bob was here, I'm sure our president, he would attest to that.
You know, that was a perfect segue into my next question because you brought up the museum just before you started the Historical Society. While these are two completely different roles that you exist in, there's got to be a lot of cross-pollination between the two. Let's talk about that a little bit. What about the museum feeds the Historical Society, and what about the Historical Society feeds your role at the museum?
Well, the museum, just to highlight kind of what the museum is first, the museum is 52-acre outdoor and indoor museum that sits off of Lake Bradford and Lake Hiawatha. It's been around since 57. We moved out to that property in 60 and then dedicated buildings in 62. It's a very dynamic institution. We have over 14 historical structures on the property. So in a lot of ways, if you kind of synthesized what Tallahassee is and put it into a place, that would be the Tallahassee Museum, in my opinion.
Shout out to Russell Dawes, who
absolutely
is a titan of
yes
the nonprofit world writ large, but here is an absolute legend. And so, yeah, that's really cool.
Yes,
and Russell is the longest serving.
That's right. Yep. Yeah. He's our proud CEO. Russell's great, and I think he was a former guest of the show, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I think I have had Russell on before.
Yep.
Absolutely. Let me ask you this.
Mm-hmm.
What does the assistant curator do at the museum?
So basically, I'm in charge of the archives, the historic buildings, and then I answer to our director of collections and exhibits, Dr. Colin Brady, who is in charge of writing grants, creating our department's budget, and then overseeing our archival interns and making sure that the buildings are well cared for preservation wise. We're actually in the process of getting the museum listed on the Register of National Historic Places as a district. Mm-hmm. So we're neck deep in that project, which is exciting. But on a day-to-day basis, I start my day by going down into the archives, checking to make sure that the temperatures and humidity are what they should be. We have over 14,000 objects in the museum's collection. A lot of people don't know that. We have two archives, one that's a natural history archive, and then one that's kind of an everything history archive. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of objects that were donated by folks in the community. So I start my day by making sure that those are acclimatized properly. Then I go to the historic structures, make sure they're acclimatized properly, and make sure there's no damage from the previous day. Then work my way back to my desk and start working on research and various exhibits that we're building out into the future.
So,
this day in the life.
I hear you. So this is art and culture-based programming. Mm. And I don't think that there's anything as important to culture as where you've been, right? In talking about the past, let's talk about some past Tallahassee history.
Let's do it.
How was Tallahassee once? What did it used to be? And I know that's a big old question for a guy like you who could eat off that bone all day, but we want you to.
No, that's a great question. And I'm going to start it by quoting a member of an early Spanish expedition into the region, Cabeza de Vaca. The town consisted of 40 small houses, low in thatch, throughout our immense trees and open woods. There were many lakes, great and small, much larger than those than we found coming here. In this province, there are many maize fields, and houses are scattered. There are deer of three kinds, and fine pastures and herds, geese in great number, royal ducks, night herons, and partridges. And that was from December 27th, 1528. So that gives you a little bit of a picture of what Tallahassee used to look like during that early first Spanish period. I mean, Tallahassee was and is kind of signified by the red hills of this region.
Sure.
Rolling hills, big open fields, lakes. And when the Spanish first came here, there was already a very rich indigenous population that had been here for already 10,000 years.
So. And that indigenous population was able mm-hmm. to settle here, right? Because it was one of the places in Florida that wasn't underwater, if I'm not mistaken.
No, that's absolutely right. Yeah. Yep, that's absolutely right. Well, the rest of Florida was underwater. The Red Hills region was kind of that early beachfront, if you will. And it gives us this real sense of ancient prehistoric history when you walk around Tallahassee.
And so then when we come from ancient to modernity, mm-hmm. this place starts to become speckled and decorated with the names of people, you know, that we will honor in this city forever. You know, one of the cool things I would imagine about your job, because just in researching for this show, one of the cool things about it for me mm-hmm. was the street names and the buildings that we pass by every day, they come to life because these were people that once lived, and now we're honoring them with street names like Lafayette or Dodd Hall or whatever, but these are the people that lived. Let's talk about some of those people. Who were some of the early celebrities or socialites that decorated this town?
Sure. Well, you mentioned Lafayette. That's a great place to start. We had a Lafayette symposium early in the year, and I mean the Tallahassee Historical Society. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of different callbacks to Lafayette when you're around the community, be it Lake Lafayette, be it, you know, plazas and centers, be it roads.
Street,
exactly, yes. Lafayette was an American Revolutionary hero who was granted a parcel of land here in the middle part of Florida, mm-hmm. and it extended all the way past Lake Lafayette. And while he never actually lived here, he inspired some French planters and colonists to come down in hopes that he would show what a free community would look like. Lafayette was an early abolitionist, and he wanted to show what a non-enslaved community would look like in this part of Florida. And that was an experiment that occurred over on Lake Lafayette primarily. And they faced some really tough times as it related to weather and clearing a lot of the thicket here. As you know, Tallahassee mm-hmm. is tree dense and tree rich, and it was just an uphill battle in terms of planting the olives and things that they brought down. But part of that community ended up in what is today Frenchtown, which has become a really rich African-American heritage-based area in Tallahassee. So.
Absolutely. So a lot of people know the name, mm-hmm. Bob Holliday.
That's right.
Now and before this, they know the name Will Gandy. Are you guys in total the Tallahassee Historical Society, or is this a network and a body of membership that's made up of a lot of people of our community?
Definitely the latter. I mean, we're a diverse big tent organization. We have 220 members. That's growing.
220 members?
220 members. Yeah, we're very proud of that. It's growing daily.
If somebody hears this program today and they're interested, how would they become a member of the Tallahassee Historical Society?
You could definitely go to our website, just Google Tallahassee Historical Society. That would be the easiest way. And you could always attend one of our meetings free of charge. And if you like what you see, then feel free to join. That's the best part, is everybody's more than welcome to come try it out. And we encourage and welcome you to attend as many meetings as you like before you join.
If I'm not mistaken, this is one of the oldest historical societies in the United States.
That's right. We were founded in 1933, and we're one of the three oldest in the state. Definitely proud of that.
Who are the other two?
Pensacola and St. Augustine, if I'm not mistaken. Definitely Pensacola. Don't quote me on St. Augustine. But
makes sense. That makes sense. So as a historian generally, who specializes in the niche of Tallahassee, this rolling hills place, what is some history that we might not know about that you could pull out of your sleeve for us?
Well, let's touch a little bit on, maybe not everybody's familiar with how Tallahassee was founded. Mm-hmm. So we could touch a little bit on that.
Sure.
So Tallahassee was and represents the middle part of Florida. So back in the day, this whole region was basically woods and lakes and rivers, and it was really unsettled for the most part, aside from some really complex indigenous strongholds here in the region. And that's even post-Spanish. So in looking for a territorial capital, Duval really wanted to establish a place here in Tallahassee that could be a middle ground, a meeting point between Pensacola and St. Augustine. So he sent two people. He sent Dr. William Simmons of St. Augustine and John Lee Williams of Pensacola to meet in a location near St. Mark's to kind of map out this region to see if it was even suitable to have a capital here. Simmons left St. Augustine on horseback. Took him 15 days to get here. Williams left Pensacola to head to St. Mark's by boat. Took him 25 days, and this was, by all accounts, an absolutely nightmarish trip.
What do you think the gas prices were like back then?
Oh, it was a steal, I'm sure, right? Yeah, no. So it took Williams 25 days, and it was a nightmarish journey. There was a doctor that was alongside of him that got lost out at sea. At one point, he had to get off and walk by land, took a raft, and then the party that was waiting for him eventually picked him up and made sure he made it safely. But yeah, interestingly enough, that's how Tallahassee was founded. And when they got here, they saw a beautiful cascading waterfall in what is today Cascades Park. And the rest is
history. Is history.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting, fascinating beginning for a place that was once just, by all accounts, a really rich and thriving indigenous population in the woods. And what made this region special was its natural beauty of lakes, rivers, these really fascinating red hills that What another fascinating bit of history, since you asked, is that they drain internally, the Red Hills do. So that's what creates all of these lakes and rivers that dot Tallahassee's landscape and give us the historical significance we do as it relates to our ecology.
That's really cool. And the biodiversity. Mm-hmm. You know, Tallahassee, you know, sometimes we catch flack, and I don't know why, because I think it's the greatest thing that God ever sculpted with his hands. Okay. But before I let you out of here, with this being culture-based but also art-based, you, I'm sure, while it may be found objects or antiques, you are dealing in art, right? Because
Absolutely.
There's stuff that also contextualizes history. How has this journey of being able to facilitate and steward just some of the most valuable collectibles in the history of this city been? Is it a burden? Is it a responsibility? Is it a joy? Tell me about it.
It's an absolute joy. Absolutely. No, it's an absolute joy. Our collection at the museum represents the breadth and diversity of this community. We have, like I said, 14,000 objects, and a good percentage of those, I would say 65 to 70% of those, tied directly back to small donors in the community. And I just think that's a wonderful testament to the interest in arts and culture in our community from an early, early time. I mean, the history of the museum calls to that establishing in 57 with the desire to really educate our community about how rich the Big Bend's history is and how rich our artistic history is as well. We had an in-house potter out at the museum, Ivan Gundrum, for a number of years that's now heavily studied out at FSU. We have the largest Ivan Gundrum collection in-house, and we're really proud of that. And we've had a number of amazing art exhibits out at the museum, from the Highwaymen to many others, to Mary Proctor more recently.
Sure.
And we're really proud of the legacy that we have artistically. And for myself, I'm just proud to to have a small hand in taking care of the community's objects and hopefully, you know, continuing to share that history going forward.
Well, you know, give yourself some credit because it's not just the one who cranks the car. It is he who steers the wheel, too. And so as our present-day wheel steerer, we appreciate you for holding it in the road. An interesting point you brought up that brought up another question for me. You said you're at 14,000 objects. Is that the cap? Or are you guys still taking stuff? And how do you decide what you take and what you don't take?
It's really all about space. Right now, we have two archives, like I mentioned, and they're really not that big. And they're both underneath our archive. They're both underneath our gallery spaces. So we have a Phipps Gallery archive and a Discovery Center archive. Mm-hmm. And the challenges of having stuff underground is immense. We're a very natural institution. We have snakes, we have bugs, we have rodents. So a lot of my challenges as it relates to object acquisitions is just space related.
Sure.
We're kind of on a cap as it relates to space, unless it's something that's super relevant to the community. Paper objects, that's always really relevant for us and easy to store. We do have an offsite storage as well, but really what we're looking to do into the future is get those objects above ground into a nice on-property storage facility that people could see. People could come by and look at the work I do, and they could, better yet, see their collection. Part of what I'm really proud about doing recently alongside our director, Dr. Colin Brady, and our interns is digitizing the collection. We have over 8,000 object photos on our website, and people could go see them today, and they could see the community members that donated these objects and learn about their histories, and we're really proud of that.
Man, in closing, I will say to you that as this place grows, as our love for it grows, obviously, we should always remember to appreciate the captains of the capsules like you, people that are maintaining this history, educating about this history, and just simply informing and enlightening. And so we appreciate you, and I appreciate you all at home for joining me again for another episode of The Warehouse, a Speaking Of show on WFSU. See you next time.
Was a pleasure. Bye-bye.
You can hear more of that conversation on our podcast, The Warehouse, available on all platforms.